good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's show, we'll hear how online learning is going for families in Colorado. It's a challenge for many, especially those that don't have easy access to the technology that's needed. Then, Antonia Juhas, award-winning investigative journalist and host of the new monthly series on KGNU, Uncovering Oil. She's giving a TEDx talk this weekend. We'll hear more about her latest investigation into the oil industry, how it's being propped up by subsidies, and what lies ahead for the future as the world moves away from carbon fuels. Then High Country News, an iconic Colorado magazine that examines issues facing the American West. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary. We'll hear more. We'll round out this morning's magazine with another food waste tip from John Lendorf. Then at 8:30, Duncan Campbell is your host on Connections. And a very special guest today, Vandana Shiva, joins Duncan live to talk about her latest book, Oneness versus the 1%, Shattering Illusions, Sending Freedom. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. A hearing is scheduled in a Denver court this morning over language that appears in Colorado's Blue Book for the November ballot. A group that is opposing a statewide ballot measure that's asking voters to repeal Colorado's Gallagher Amendment is suing the state and the General Assembly over language in the guide that will go to all voters in the state. The group, Protect Our Homes Colorado, is against Amendment B that will appear on November's ballot. The group says that the language in Colorado's Blue Book or Voter's Guide fails to provide a fair and impartial analysis of Amendment B, as is required by the Colorado State Constitution. Their complaint says that last-minute edits made to the language were included in the Blue Book, and they do not give a clear picture of what the group says the harm that the Gallagher repeal or Amendment B would do for Coloradans. The Denver Post reports that the measure was referred to the ballot by a bipartisan group of lawmakers at the end of this year's legislative session. The Gallagher Amendment was passed by voters in 1982, and it limits residential property taxes. It brings them down to nearly the lowest in the country. However, those who support Amendment B and who support repealing the Gallagher Amendment say that local authorities depend on property taxes and that the Gallagher Amendment limits their ability to raise and spend money, and this is particularly impactful for education. More than 75% of recent claims made for unemployment assistance under a program created to help self-employed workers and independent contractors were fraudulent, according to the Colorado Department of Labor. Steve Miller has more.
In Colorado, under the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, PUA, only 23% of initial claims made for self-employed workers and independent contractors since July 18th are legitimate. The Denver Post reports that the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment said that they have prevented $750 million to $1 billion in improper unemployment insurance payments. But about $40 million in federal money may have slipped through to the criminals. Jeff Fitzgerald, head of the state's unemployment insurance program, said in order to catch the fraudulent claims, the state uses 18 fraud detection measures. Some of the perpetrators are based in Colorado, some in other states, and some abroad. Scammers use stolen identities to file a claim. They set up accounts at banks for direct deposit. It is up to the state employment offices to make sure those who file are who they claim to be. Many fraudulent claims were caught when the CDLE mailed a debit card, known as Relia card, to the address under which a claim was filed, even when applicants requested a direct deposit. Thousands of Colorado residents were surprised when they received the cards, not knowing that their identities had been used in the scam. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Warmer temperatures around the Front Range today, highs in the mid to upper 60s, getting into the 70s for tomorrow, and getting close to 80 degrees by Sunday. You're listening to The Morning Magazine here at KGNU. Families around Colorado have been working to balance the return to school in the recent weeks. Some school districts have in-person learning, others are online, and some students are doing a combination of the two. But for those doing any type of online learning, access to technology is desperately needed to succeed. And for many, that is in and of itself a barrier. KGNU's Rosanna Longo has more.
My name is Naima, and I go to Escuela Bilingue Pioneer. And learning online is a little bit trickier since we started learning about Schoology. And it's just a little harder because when everyone's on it, it's all slow. And sometimes it can be really hard because everyone is learning at once, and it can be a little frustrating.
That was Naima. She's a student at Pioneer Elementary in Lafayette and is one of the thousands of students across Colorado dealing with online learning, like her friend Rose.
My name is Rose and I go to Escuela Bilingue Pioneer. Online school isn't the best thing. I mean, I like that we have the comfort of our own home, but then it's like you get distracted by everything that you do have at home, and at school you don't have that access. So I feel like it would be better if we did in person, but then online is also better for the situation currently. But yeah, I agree, it's like hard and confusing.
For Rose, there are things that are confusing, especially in math.
Our class has these slides with some easy, like, multiplication or division question or whatever. And a lot of people can solve those easily because they actually caught up with stuff, even though we've been in quarantine for about 7 months. But it's a bit confusing as they answer a lot quicker than you do, and you're still figuring it out, and then they just blurt out the said answer in chat. And you're like, oh, well, that's the answer. I guess I didn't need to work it out. And the teacher, I can tell they don't recognize this. They're just like, oh, okay, three students have said the answer. Yeah, let's move on to the next slide. I don't really care about the
Naima
other students.
Also struggles with the challenges presented by digital learning.
And like sometimes I won't get something, and then literally just like three students will type it in chat, and then the two on and don't get an actual chance to write it down. And it's really like hard to do it because like some people they catch on quicker, and if they like write it in the chat, like the teacher will say write it in the chat in 5 minutes, and then they'll do it like right after she says that.
But there are things that Naima and Rose like about learning online.
And I like how, one, in Peridot, it's like really like actually fun. But also in Google Meet, I like how like instead of like raising your hand in the thing or doing a thumbs up, you can click a button in the side that raises your hand or gives you a thumbs up.
Naima remembers her friend Carmen, a classmate that she has seen first today since the beginning of online classes because she didn't have Wi-Fi.
Like today for the first time I saw Carmen, which is one of the girls I haven't seen in any of the classes,
yeah.
But I saw her in Miss Betty's class.
It might not just be Wi-Fi, it might just be her not wanting to attend classes. It's something normal
people,
from her.
Some people do that, like they just don't attend classes, and the teacher like in Google Hangouts will be like, why didn't you do that? And she's like, and they're just like, oh, because I don't have Wi-Fi. Some people do that.
Lara Mamatre is Naima's mom and Digital Divide program coordinator from Bridging the Digital Divide, a community initiative concerned in closing the digital gap. She says it is important more than ever now with the increased need for internet accessibility, especially in education.
So over the last 10 years, BVSD has been moving to an increasingly digital interface. So report cards are online, the applications for free and reduced lunch are online, and every year they require parents to do what's called an annual data update, which is just to update your contact information, number of people in the house, etc. And they were finding that they had a hard time getting this done. A lot of parents didn't have the internet at home, they didn't have a computer, and so what they did is they would set up days at the beginning of the school year where parents could come in. They would have people there who spoke Spanish and English to help guide them through the process, and they would go into the computer lab at the school and they would do it. Well, this is great, but it doesn't solve the problem on the other end. So this solves the problem for the schools. They get their updates, they get what they need, but it's not helping with the problem is becoming clear that there are people who don't have access to internet, who don't have a computer at home, and who don't really know how to fill out a form like that.
Pan Matre says many families are having difficulties in accessing the technology.
Other organizations that were seeing problems were organizations like WIC, organizations like, Housing and Human Services. They're all seeing people who didn't have the ability to fill out by themselves a form for benefits, check their benefits online. Social Security benefits are only able to be checked online now. You know, they're strongly encouraging people in all of these services to use online portals to check their benefits, to get updates, to receive notifications, to update information. CCAP, for example, is another organization that reached out to me for help. You now have to have an email address and you have to have an account online to use your CCAP benefits. And a lot of people had trouble getting registered for CCAP and receiving their benefits and getting help with childcare. So this is something that even before the pandemic, we are seeing, we are more and more requiring people to have a very basic level of digital skills and literacy to be able to participate fully in society, to receive benefits, and to get ahead. And so this was what brought a group together to try to find a dedicated person and to fund a program that would attack both the lack of connection. We know there was a full 14% of the Boulder County population at that time that was not connected, that we know of. And that's from census data, so not everyone fills out the census, and a lot of the people who don't fill out the census are the ones who are not connected. After that, we have the problem with if they are connected, there's a lot you can't do with a cell phone. You know, I hear this argument all the time. Oh, well, everyone I see has a cell phone. Well, I mean, it's really hard to upload a document from a cell phone. It's really hard to fill out some online forms because the website just might not be configured for mobile use. It's really hard to fill out a CV, right? A resume. It is hard to apply for a job. There's a lot of things. It's hard to write a term paper, right? It's hard to sometimes access spreadsheets when you only have a cell phone. And the last piece was the actual knowledge. We take for granted that everyone knows how to use email, that everyone is checking their email. We take for granted that it's easy to fill out an online form. It's not for everybody. It's not easy for them to navigate the internet, to be safe on the internet, to not be taken advantage of, to know where and how and what words to use in a Google search to find what you're looking for, to typing incorrectly, to all of these things that we take for granted.
Pan Matre says this is especially true for newcomers in our society who grew up in places where computers were not part of everyday life. She says there is a bigger problem now because internet accessibility is not a luxury anymore, but essential for almost every aspect in society, especially now for work and school.
The problem is, though, now it is not just a luxury, right? We used to view internet as something like a luxury, right? Now it is more like what's the fourth utility, right? You need to have water, electricity, heat, and internet, right? So for education and for work, for most people, they need at least in some way to connect to the internet for their work or for education, right? And so now that the school, there used to be a distinction between the home and the school, right? And so maybe there was a lot of inequality with what children faced in their home lives and their economic situations, but everyone was supposed to be treated the same when they got to school. Everyone was supposed to have the same opportunities when they got to school, right? We're no child left behind, right? We're not going to discriminate, right? We're going to give everyone the opportunity to get the best education they possibly can. Well, that's not true if the people are in their homes, in homes are not equal.
According to the Colorado Department of Education and the Colorado Education Initiative, more than 65,000 students in Colorado lack internet access. The state of Colorado is spending $2 million to provide internet access to students who are learning from home during the COVID-19 pandemic. These steps will go some way towards closing the digital divide, and advocates like Lara Van Matre say that it is urgent that this issue is addressed.
We can't address every aspect of homes being equal, but having internet in your home when it is essential for your work or for your school is one that we can and must address.
For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
Antonia Juhas is an award-winning journalist and an author who's been investigating the oil and gas industry for many years. She's now based in Colorado and she's hosting a monthly show here on KGNU called Uncovering Oil. Well, this Sunday she's speaking as part of TEDxCU. And the subject of her talk is how women and girls are leading the way to end the fossil fuel era. And the recent reporting that Antonia has been doing on the fossil fuel industry shows exactly why that is needed now more than ever.
The Trump administration is trying to prop up this industry in the wake of COVID-19. But it's probably a losing effort because everything else is stacked against the oil industry. So you've got an industry before COVID-19 that was already sort of the biggest problem that it had was that it was overproducing. You had countries and companies that to just because demand, the growth of demand was cratering, price of oil was cratering, again, before COVID-19. Investors were moving away, banks were starting to move away, activists and organizers had been forcing government policy to shift to embrace renewables, to move away from oil and gas, and that's happening on a global scale. They were already looking towards what is described as the peak of oil demand, that the world's already at this place where this is as much as we're gonna buy and we're not gonna buy anymore. And they had already, to try and to sort of stay on top of that, if your economy or your business is dependent on selling oil, they had to produce more and more and more to make the same or less amount of money. And so this overproduction problem was already happening. And then COVID-19 hit and demand cratered even further. But for quite a few months, even after the pandemic started hitting, the industry kept pumping. And so that's when we saw the, like the tankers stacked up across the world, filled with oil, just this glut. And we've come out of it a little bit because people have started driving again, and companies and countries have constrained production, but there still is this glut. And now there is an even greater urgency among political leaders and countries and activists and people to say, like, this just isn't where we should be putting our money. And I do, I really believe that all of those are signs that the industry, if we remove in particular the $5 trillion a year globally that is subsidizes the global oil industry, the government subsidizes the industry, if that is removed, if government policy is put in place, and it's really key, that focuses on really starting to implement what's called the managed decline of oil production, keeping this oil in the ground in a managed way. So the places that can go first do go first. Communities that are hardest hit by oil production without receiving benefits go first to sort of really start constraining production, like we're doing in Colorado, sort of regulate it into a much smaller window through which it can produce. Between those policies and removing subsidies, there's just very little future left for any sort of for an oil industry that looks like the oil industry that we have now, particularly these thousands of fracking companies that just never made money. And then if you look at a company, for example, like BP, one of the largest oil companies in the world, it announced a plan to reduce by 40% the amount of oil it produces in 10 years. Exxon was just delisted from the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the first time in almost 100 years. Like, these changes are starting to happen, and I think we're really at this pinnacle that's going to go one way or the other, depending on how public policy moves. Will we see soon the end of oil, or will we double down through pouring our resources into it and our policy into it to support it and try and prop it up for you know, more decades.
Antonia Juhas will speak on how women and girls are leading the way to the end of the fossil fuel era. It's part of the TEDxCU talk happening this Sunday, September 13th, from 3 to 5pm. It's all online and you can register at TEDxCU.com. And you can catch Antonia Juhas's show on KGNU Uncovering Oil on the third Thursday of every month at 6pm on It's the Economy. And you can listen to all of the back episodes online at news.kgnu.org. Just search for Uncovering Oil. High Country News, the non-profit news magazine that's headquartered in Paonia, Colorado, is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Founded in Lander, Wyoming in 1970, the publication relocated to Paonia in 1983 under the leadership of Ed and Betsy Marston. Well, High Country News became well known for its deep dives into the stories of the West's complex environmental and natural resources issues, as well as taking a look at its diverse communities and cultures. The latest leader of High Country News is executive director and publisher Greg Hanscom. He was hired in March of this year. KVNF's Gavin Dahl spoke with Greg and he asked him about the evolution of the magazine's staff model to include a broader range of perspectives across the West, including more native voices.
You know, for years we were really based in Paonia and almost the entire staff was there in town. In the last 5 years, we have dispersed, especially our editorial staff is now scattered all over the Western United States from, you know, I'm in Seattle. We've got a staffer in Portland. We've got somebody in Norman, Oklahoma. We've got a little team in Tucson, somebody in Moscow, Idaho. And the shift has really allowed us to better cover this region. We cover a million square miles. It's a big old beat for us. And this helps us put feet on the ground and reporters out on the streets for, you know, to cover stories that are happening in real time. It has also been a really important move for us in terms of being able to attract and hang on to a much more diverse staff. So we have, you know, I think if you look at our editorial staff today, it's far more racially diverse in particular than it ever was when we were purely based in Paonia. And that includes an Indigenous Affairs desk, which is, to my knowledge, the only one of its kind for a non-Indigenous publication. It's staffed largely by Indigenous journalists, and we're able to provide some really unique insights into Indian country, into many tribal nations that are scattered around the Western United States. I think it's really kind of cracked open High Country News and the story of the West. You know, you can't understand this region if you don't understand the diverse communities here. And this place is only getting more and more diverse as we go. So it's been a really important transition for us.
In your own career, you've led and participated in some successful collaborations. Lately, HCN has continued to innovate with the Wildish podcast and other projects. It seems like you are determined not to exist in a silo. What's your thinking on that?
Absolutely. You know, I think that the print magazine continues to be kind of our core product, right? This is our most powerful connection to our core audience, you know, the people who provide 3/4 of the revenue for this organization. So we still put a lot of love and a lot of care into this print magazine. But more and more when we look at opportunities for growth and expansion, a lot of that is digital. A lot of that is on the web through discussion platforms, social media, and a lot of that is through collaborations with other media organizations as well. I think that the days when news organizations looked at each other with great suspicion as kind of the evil competitor are long gone. I think at this point, you know, local news in particular has taken a massive hit in the last couple of decades. And I think we all realize that we need each other right now. And I think we all realize that we're stronger together.
Greg Hanscom is executive director and publisher of High Country News, kicking off their 50th anniversary. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Community Radio KGNU, and it's time now for another food waste tip from John Lendorf.
Hi, Hi, it's John Lindor from KGNU's Radio Nibbles, here with another practical way to cut food waste, save flavor, and save some money. For instance, far too many millions of pounds of apples grown in the United States never get eaten at all and are a surprisingly common item in our trash and compost. Do this instead. First, store your apples in a cool, dark, well-ventilated place, not necessarily the refrigerator. Also, choose the right apples. Avoid mealy, delicious apples and go for the tastier, firmer Granny Smiths and Jonathans. If you have some apples that are oddly shaped or have a brown spot or imperfections, you go ahead and trim and peel them, and then you can simmer those pieces down in a pan to make applesauce. Add a little bit of cinnamon and honey if you like. You can add those apple chunks to, you can freeze them, and then add them to smoothies as you make smoothies, along with the peel. Apple peel has a ton of fiber in it, and actually if you're taking a fiber supplement, chances are it's pectin from apple peels. The cooked apples can be added to oatmeal, and they can also be baked into breads and cakes and muffins. Remember, composting. That's your very last resort. And you can find more food waste information and ideas at news.kgnu.org.
And you can catch John Lendorf on Friday mornings sharing his tips on how to reduce food waste. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for tuning in to The Morning Magazine. Up next, it's Connections.